All right. Well, thanks very much for having me come and talk. So there have been a lot of exciting developments in the past few years in the field of massive gravity. And as the title implies, these developments have in fact allowed us to construct new low energy theories of gravity that go beyond the usual massive gravity picture. So this is what I'm going to talk about during this talk. But before I dive in, just to give you some context. So the driving question behind, I would say, all of my research projects is what can fundamental physics tell us about macroscopic phenomena? So thus far, I've been looking at this question in three different contexts. So the first of these is what can quantum field theory tell us about astrophysical objects? So this is work that I started as a PhD student with Gregory Gabadazzi at NYU. And what we postulated is that in the cores of certain white dwarf stars, the conditions are just right that you can have a new kind of quantum liquid. So this is a condensate of charged spin zero nuclei. So in the case of these white dwarf stars, these are helium nuclei. And we, using effective field theory techniques, we were able to investigate various different and interesting properties of this condensate, like charge screening, the formation of magnetized vortices, and predict observational consequences for the cooling rate of these stars. So this is one of the projects I've been working on. I've also been looking, this is at Columbia now with Alberto Nicolis and Ricardo Penko, at applications of effective field theory for hydrodynamics. So our hope is, again, using the tools of effective field theory, we can make model independent statements for fluid dynamics based just on low energy degrees of freedom and symmetry considerations. And finally, what I'm going to be talking about today is the question, what can particle physics tell us about low energy gravity? So the motivation for this question, I should say, is that basically the compelling mysteries of fundamental physics, of dark matter and dark energy, these all rely on a standard picture of general relativity. So it behooves us to ask, are there any alternatives? Is there something else that we can do? And it makes sense that we should look to particle physics for insights into these questions. So this is work that I've done with Fawad Hassan at Stockholm University, with Kurt Hinderbinkler, who's here, and more recently with Claudia Durem and Andrew Tully. All right, so I'm going to start by taking the approach of a pure relativistic quantum field theorist to gravity. So I'm going to throw out what I know about general relativity, including the beautiful geometric picture. And I'm going to start just using insights and the tools that we have from relativistic quantum field theory to try and build up a phenomenologically viable theory of gravity. So what are these insights that I'm going to use? So you can say two things. So one, particles are characterized by their mass and their spin. And secondly, forces are mediated by the exchange of bosons. All right, so if I'm going to be a good field theorist, I should start with the simplest possible picture and ask, well, can I have a spin zero particle mediating the gravitational force? So I want a long range force, so let me start for simplicity with a massless scalar field. So my field carries no indices, so it has to couple to the trace of the stress energy tensor, and it does so with a coupling G. So in this scalar theory of gravity, I can calculate the potential between two point particles, and I find, in fact, that I do recover the correct Newtonian potential here. All right, so that's an initial success. If I want, there's no problem in adding a small mass to this scalar field. So this is going to show up in the potential as a Yukawa type suppression here. And as long as this mass is sufficiently small, say of order Hubble scales, there's no problem with observational constraints in the scalar particle being massive. However, and this is a problem for both the massless and massive spin zero gravity, is that because the scalar only couples to the trace of the stress energy tensor, light is not going to be coupled to gravity. And because of this, my scalar theory of gravity is not going to be able to recover the bending of light around massive objects. So we can rule out this scalar theory of gravity based on solar system tests. All right, so let me go up the chain one more. Spin zero didn't work. Let me try spin one. So here I introduce a massless spin one field, and let me couple it to a point particle in this way. where here x mu is the world line of the point particle that I'm considering. Now, already this theory is a little bit funny because the current that I'm coupling to is not positive definite. However, let me plow ahead and still calculate the potential between two point particles. And what I found and what you find and what you can anticipate is that positive massive repel for this spin one gravity theory. So spin one can't provide a viable theory of gravity. All right, well, let's look at our remaining options. So I know that for high spin particles, spin three or greater, these can't couple. There aren't any conserved sources that these guys can couple to, and therefore I can't use these to mediate long range theories of gravity. And so that leaves me with a spin two field as my only viable choice for a theory of gravity. All right, so let's start by looking at a massless spin two field. And let's look at the linear action. So I want an action that describes a massless spin two, but I also want it to have this manifest Lorentz invariance. So the simplest way to do this is to introduce a symmetric rank two tensor, because in its decomposition, I get this spin two guy here. However, because I'm insisting on Lorentz invariance, the symmetric rank two tensor also comes along with all this extra baggage. So these two helicity zero modes, or sorry, spin zero modes and spin one modes for a total of 10 components. So I need to get rid of these extra components in order to describe the massless spin two field. And the way that we do that is that we pick the coefficients of these kinetic terms here so that my action has an overall gauge invariance, the usual linearized form of diff invariance. And it's through this gauge invariance that I can go from the 10 components of my rank two symmetric tensor down to the two physical propagating degrees of freedom of the massless graviton. All right, so again, I calculate the potential between two point particles. I recover the correct Newtonian potential. And now, because my graviton couples to the full stress energy tensor and not just the trace, I get the correct bending of light for this theory. And of course, there are a host of many other observational tests of linearized GR. But the problem is that, in fact, if I couple this theory to a dynamical source, the linearized theory is inconsistent. And that has to do with the fact that my linear gauge invariance implies a conservation of the stress tensor, the exact conservation of the matter stress tensor. So what this means is that a dynamical matter source or matter field can't exchange energy with my gravitational field. So if you apply this, say, for a point particle, this would tell you that, in fact, a point particle isn't going to accelerate in a gravitational field, which, of course, we know is inconsistent. So the resolution to this problem is that I should take the stress tensor for the matter sector, and I should add to it the stress energy coming from the gravitational sector, which is going to be second order in fields. OK, so this is what I should have in my equations of motion. But in order to get this in my equations of motion, I have to add a piece to my Lagrangian, or to my action, that's cubic order in my spin two field, in this h mu nu. Now, of course, that's going to generate a cubic order piece in my stress tensor, and so on. So I have to keep adding more terms to my action and keep adding more terms to the effective stress tensor here. And you find if you keep doing this procedure iteratively, you end up, unsurprisingly, or perhaps surprisingly, at general relativity. So what I can do is I can introduce a field redefinition here, where I write this tensor g mu nu in terms of this original flat background that I started out with, plus my perturbation. And then remarkably, in the full theory of general relativity, the flat background reference metric drops out, and I'm just left with a fully dynamical theory for g mu nu. And this theory has a full nonlinear diff invariance, which is again responsible for taking the initial 10 components of g mu nu down to the two physical degrees of freedom of the massless graviton. So it's through this method that we can make this statement that GR is the only consistent Poincaré invariant low energy theory of interacting massless spin two particles. Okay, so let's return to this field theorist approach to gravity. So we have this great statement now about massless spin two particles. We've ruled out spin zero, spin one, and higher spin for a theory of gravity. The only thing that remains is, what about massive spin two fields? Is it possible to have a consistent theory of gravity in which gravity is mediated by a massive spin two field? So in order to formulate a massive theory of gravity, I'm again going to start with a linear theory. So I'm going to take the kinetic term for the massless spin two field, and I'm going to add to it mass terms of the form h mu nu, and h squared as well. So these terms explicitly break the diff invariance of the theory. And because it was this diff invariance that was responsible for giving me the two helicity states of the massless spin two, I should now recount the number of degrees of freedom that I have. So I know that a massive graviton should have 5 propagating degrees of freedom. Because the kinetic term, the linearized Einstein-Hilbert term, is still on its own invariant under diff invariances, it ends up giving me on shell 4 constraints for my h mu nu here. So the starting 10 components minus the 4 constraints, I end up with 6 propagating degrees of freedom. Now this is problematic, and it's not just problematic because I have an extra degree of freedom. It's problematic because this extra degree of freedom is generically a pathological degree of freedom. It has a wrong sign kinetic term. It means that you have an instability in your theory, and it's referred to as a ghost. All right, so I want to get rid of this extra degree of freedom. So the way in which I can do that is I can introduce mass terms with this particular tuning between the h mu nu piece and the h squared piece, and this was done by Fiertz and Pauli. And once I do that, what I find is, in fact, there's an additional constraint in this theory on the trace of h, and this additional constraint removes the extra pathological degree of freedom and gives me the 5 degrees of freedom that I would expect for a massive graviton. It's valid on the equations of motion, but it doesn't follow. Yeah. But you need this piece as well, and then it follows from these. Okay, yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah. All right, so what about the coupling with matter? So again, let me couple this massive graviton to the stress tensor in the same way that I would for the massless graviton. And again, calculate the potential between 2-point particles. So I find the usual Yukawa suppression that I would expect from having a massive spin two field. But in addition, I get an extra factor of 4/3 that appears in front of this, in front of my potential. Now, in and of itself, that's not so bad, because what I can do is I can rescale my Planck mass so that I don't notice any difference between observations. But when I do that, I mess up the bending of light by this same factor of 4/3. So again, it would seem that the linearized theory of massive gravity would fail to be a phenomenologically viable theory of gravity. So this is a manifestation of what's known as the VDVZ discontinuity, which is simply the statement that the m goes to zero limit of massive gravity does not recover general relativity. Now, this is a funny statement because that means that observationally we would be able to distinguish between a graviton that has an arbitrarily small mass and a graviton whose mass is pure, truly mathematically zero. And the other statement, of course, is that this means that in principle we could rule out massive gravity.
For any mass,
that's right. That's right. However, it was Weinstein who pointed out a loophole in this argument. And what he found is that if you have a nonlinear theory of massive gravity, that these nonlinearities become important at surprisingly large distances. So that's given by this scale, R Weinstein here. And this is in contrast to the Schwarzschild radius for GR, at which nonlinearities usually become important. So the hope would be that if you had the right nonlinear completion of a massive gravity theory, these nonlinearities could be such that, in fact, at short distances, you do recover general relativity, and you get the right bending of light in our solar system so that you get a phenomenologically viable theory. All right, so the question that we want to answer then is there a nonlinear theory of gravity that realizes the Weinstein mechanism? And also, does it continue to maintain the constraint at the full nonlinear level and thus avoid this extra pathological degree of freedom? So in fact, there was a paper in 1972 by Bulwar and Deser, who argued that you always, once you introduce nonlinearities in the theory, you always reintroduced this pathological ghost-like degree of freedom. So this became known as the Bulwar-Deser ghost. All right, but in the last couple years, in fact, there was a group of people who pointed out a caveat in the original arguments of Bulwar and Deser. So this was Duram, Gabadazzi, and Tolle. And they proposed a candidate theory for a full nonlinear theory of massive gravity. And they were able to show that this candidate theory avoided the ghost problem up to quartic order in small perturbations. So in work with Fawad Hassan, in fact, we were able to show that this theory does have an extra constraint that kills off the ghost at the fully nonlinear level. So this is a fully ghost-free theory of massive gravity. And then in work with Kurt Hinterbickler, we were able to cast this theory in this nice form in terms of Fierbinds, which turns out to be very convenient for counting degrees of freedom and doing other manipulations. So the theory looks like the following. I have the usual Einstein-Hilbert term for my Fierbind. And in addition, I have these mass terms for the Fierbind, which are simply every possible combination using wedges of the dynamical Fierbind E with the background Minkowski Fierbind, which here I've denoted by 1. So there are 5 possible terms that you can write down. So these basically look like generalized volume elements. So what are these terms? Well, the first one is just the usual cosmological constant. So that's not anything new. It's just the determinant of E. The last of these terms, because I have this static reference metric, is in fact just a pure number and doesn't contribute to the theory. But these 3 terms here, these represent my genuine interaction terms. And I can take the coefficients and I can relabel one of them, or I can make one combination correspond to the mass, and then I have an additional 2 free parameters in the theory. So in this theory, in addition to the Planck mass, the cosmological constant, and the mass of the graviton, I have 2 arbitrary dimensionless parameters as well. All right, so how do we see that this theory removes the ghost? Well, let's do a nitty-gritty counting of the dynamical degrees of freedom. So in order to do this, I'm going to take my Fierbind, this guy here, which is a 4x4 matrix and has 16 components. And I'm going to decompose it using ADM variables. So I'm going to decompose it into a lapse, which has 1 component, a shift, 3 components, a boost parameter P, another 3 components, and then the spatial part of the Fierbind, which I'm going to call E hat, which has 9 components. And I'm going to do it in the following way. So I'm going to take the full Fierbind, and I'm going to write it as a Lorentz boost times an upper triangular Fierbind, where it's the upper triangular Fierbind that includes the lapse and the shift and the spatial component as well. All right, so when I write my action in terms of these variables, what I find is that these 7 guys, the lapse, the shift, and the boost, they appear without time derivatives in my action, and they're thus non-dynamical. Through rotational invariance, I can, in fact, on shell, remove 3 components of the spatial Fierbind here so that I only have 6 potentially propagating degrees of freedom, which means that I'm also going to introduce 6 canonically conjugate momenta for the Fierbind. So I'm going to do this in terms of canonical variables. So that gives me a total of 6 plus 6, 12 phase space degrees of freedom. So this is for a generic theory of massive gravity. I would have this counting. And of course, you see the extra ghost mode here because this is twice 6 phase-based degrees of freedom. But let me look at what happens in the specific form for the specific action that I had a few slides earlier for this ghost-free massive gravity action. So when I plug in these variables, what I find is the following. I find that my action is in fact linear in both the lapse and the shift. So I can write it as a function of E hat, P, and pi, and then plus these 2 functions that are linear in N and Ni. And what this means is that the lapse and the shift act as constraints on the other components. So in particular, if I vary this action with respect to ni, I find the constraint ci is equal to 0. So these are three constraints, and I can use them to solve for the p parameters in terms of e hat and pi. All right, if I plug back into my action now, I have an action that depends only on e hat and pi and the lapse n. So now I can look at the constraint coming from the variation of n. So I get some c equals to 0. And now this becomes a constraint on my dynamical variable. So the 12 dynamical variables that I introduced, one of them gets eliminated through this constraint. So this eliminates one phase-based degree of freedom. OK, but I need to eliminate both the ghost mode and its canonically conjugate momentum. So what I can do is see if this, if my original constraint C, if it generates an associated secondary constraint. And what this basically means is that in order for my theory to be consistent, this constraint has to be maintained in time. So that is to say that the ddt of C equals 0, or equivalently the Poisson bracket of C with a Hamiltonian, has to vanish. And you can show that by imposing this condition, in fact, you get another constraint on the dynamical degrees of freedom. And this eliminates the second phase space degree of freedom. So now when I count dynamical variables, I have the original 6 coming from the Fierbein, another 6 from its conjugate momentum, and then minus the two constraints coming from my Hamiltonian constraint and the associated secondary constraint. So this gives me the right number of phase space degrees of freedom for the massive graviton. That's for any value of the three parameters. So it's coming from the fact that the action that you get is linear in the lapse and shift. And that in and of itself is coming from, you can actually sort of read it off from this structure here based on the fact that the epsilon tensor only picks out one zero component. And that means it's only ever going to pick out one lapse or one shift from the Fierbein variables. OK, so these are the successes of this nonlinear massive spin 2 theory. So we've seen that it propagates no additional pathological degrees of freedom. So it's free of this Bulwer-Desert ghost, which means that it's a theoretically viable theory. You can show that for a generic range of parameter space, so generic values for these beta n, this theory does in fact exhibit a Weinstein mechanism, which makes it a phenomenologically viable theory. And interestingly as well, there's been work done to show that this theory has cosmological solutions which exhibit accelerated expansion without the introduction of a cosmological constant. And the reason why this is interesting is because in these theories, the value of the cosmological constant, of the effective cosmological constant, so the value of the accelerated expansion that you get, is given by the mass of the graviton. And this mass is a technically natural parameter, simply because when I set the mass equal to 0, I recover my diff invariance. So this is a way you can get a technically natural solution, not to the old cosmological constant, but to the new cosmological constant problem. So beta zero is a cosmological constant. So what these accelerated solutions found is that without introducing the beta zero piece, you still can get accelerated expansion. So without explicitly putting in the CCPs, yeah. All right, so let's return again to our field theorist approach to gravity. So we found that GR is the only consistent Poincaré invariant low energy theory of interacting massless spin 2 particles. We now have a two parameter family of consistent Poincaré invariant low energy theories of interacting massive spin 2 particles. We can keep pushing this line of questioning and ask, what about interactions between many spin 2 fields? Is that possible? Now, if you only have massless spin 2 fields, the answer is no. You can't have interactions between the two. And one way that you can see this is that if I have two massless spin 2 fields that don't interact with each other, then I have two separate diff invariances that are each responsible for making these guys massless. But as soon as I introduce interaction terms between the two, I break down the two diff invariances into a diagonal subgroup of the two. So now I only have one overall diff invariance, which isn't enough to give me two interacting massless spin 2s. But now that I have consistent theories of massive spin 2s, maybe it's possible to get interactions between many spin 2s.
Sorry, I forgot that.
Yeah.
You're talking about direct interaction?
So that's still going to violate your, so even if they interact through the same massive field, you're still only going to have one overall diff invariance. And so it's still only enough to give you one massless graviton. All right, so the most natural thing to do is to take this ghost-free nonlinear massive gravity theory that we have and to take this fixed Minkowski reference metric that we have and promote it to a fully dynamical field of its own. So now I have two propagating Feuerbinds. I have an Einstein-Hilbert kinetic term for each one, so I'm calling them E1 and E2. And now I have mass terms, which are simply all possible wedge products of my two different Feuerbinds, E1 and E2. So this theory has one overall diff invariance. And in fact, you can show that when you promote this reference metric to a dynamical field, it doesn't disrupt the Hamiltonian constraint that you found earlier. So this theory still has a Hamiltonian constraint, which removes the extra possible propagating degree of freedom. So between the diff invariance and the extra constraint, you have a consistent theory of one massless spin 2 interacting with one massive spin 2 field. All right, so I can represent this theory graphically. So let me, for each Feuerbein I have with its own Einstein-Hilbert kinetic term, I can represent by a circle here or here. And then for the interaction between the two, let me indicate that by a line going in between the two Feuerbeins. So with this representation, it's easy to construct theories of many spin 2 fields interacting with each other. So the idea is that each time I introduce a new spin 2 field into my interactions without introducing an associated diff invariance, I'm introducing potentially 6 propagating degrees of freedom rather than 5. So each time I do this, I'm going to need to also introduce an additional constraint that eliminates the extra degree of freedom. And it turns out that by constructing theories in this way, so using these wedge product interactions between the two, whenever you introduce a new graviton into your theory, you always introduce a new constraint as well, which eliminates the extra degree of freedom. So what you find is that for a theory space that looks like this, each disconnected diagram is going to give you one massless spin 2 field. So that's related to the one overall diff invariance of each diagram. And in addition, you're going to have n minus 1 massive spin 2 fields and no additional ghost-like extra degrees of freedom. So it turns out there are some interesting distinctions between tree graphs. So that's graphs with no closed loops and loop graphs. So in particular for the tree graph, every time I have an interaction between, say, some EI and EJ, this shows up in my Lagrangian as the form EI inverse EJ. And for a tree graph, it turns out that it's dynamically equivalent to take this action written in terms of the Feuerbeins and replace it with an action written in terms of metrics, where I've replaced the E inverse I, EJ, by square root of GI inverse GJ. So for a tree graph, each Feuerbein theory has a dynamically equivalent theory written in terms of metrics as well. But it turns out that for the loop graph, this conversion no longer holds. So as far as we know, we can write down ghost-free theories with loop graphs using Feuerbeins, which may not have equivalent metric formulations as well. All right, but that's right. So on shell, it would give you the same theory.
Is the way you derived, the way you showed it was ghost-free, it seems to be essential to write the theory?
So in fact, that only, so for the proof of ghost freedom, it helps in terms of Feuerbein variables, but there is a way to show ghost freedom in terms of metric variables as well. And in fact, that's what we did first before we found the Feuerbein formulation, in which case it was much simpler in the Feuerbein formulation. Yeah. So very good. So what happens is in the metric formulation, when you write everything in terms of canonical variables, your action is no longer invariant, or sorry, it's no longer linear in both the lapse and the shift. In fact, both lapse and shift appear nonlinearly. However, you can show that when you vary with respect to lapse and shift, So you get four equations, but these equations turn out to be degenerate. And so one of the equations, in fact, can be used to kill off the extra degree of freedom. But it's a much more subtle process showing that these equations are degenerate. All right, so now in addition to massless spin two particles, massive spin two particles, we have a very large family of consistent Poincaré invariant low energy theories of multiple interacting spin two particles. All right, so one more thing that we can ask if we're adopting this approach of relativistic field theory is what about other representations? Do I have to use Poincaré representations? And so what do I mean by this? Well, so we've observed late time acceleration, and we believe that this means that our universe today can be well approximated by a de Sitter space-time. So de Sitter is the solution to Einstein's vacuum equations with positive cosmological constant. And the thing about de Sitter is that, like Minkowski, it's a maximally symmetric space with 10 isometries. So what this means is we can also use the isometries of de Sitter to classify particles, to write down irreducible representations of the isometry group of de Sitter instead. So naively, I wouldn't expect to get something very different than what I get from the Poincaré group, especially given that the de Sitter radius that we see is so large, I would expect only small corrections. But let's go ahead and see. All right, so here is a plot of representations of the de Sitter group. And my two axes, so one is given by the mass of the graviton, and this is given by the curvature. Sorry, my y-axis is given by the curvature of my de Sitter space. And what you find is the following. So when m squared is equal to 0, so that corresponds to this line here, I only propagate 2 degrees of freedom. And essentially, I'm back at usual general relativity in this case. But now, in the case of de Sitter space-time, there's a range of parameter space when m squared is less than 1/6 r. That the helicity zero mode of my massive graviton becomes unstable. However, for m squared greater than 1/6 r, the helicity mode is in fact stable, and I'm back in a regime where I propagate 5 healthy degrees of freedom. However, at the crossover between these two points here, in fact, the kinetic term for the helicity zero mode vanishes, and at the linear level, this theory propagates only 4 degrees of freedom. That's what we're going to talk about. Yeah. Okay, so this theory here is referred to as partially massless gravity. And the reason for this, why it's called partially massless, is because, so in flat space time, we know that the properties of gauge invariance, of masslessness, of propagating on the light cone, all these three things go together. But it turns out that in de Sitter space time, that's no longer true. So here we're going to see we have an example of a theory with a gauge symmetry, which is not, in fact, a massless symmetry. So it's referred to as partially massless. All right, so there's a field theory that realizes this representation. So basically, I write my usual massive gravity theory, but now with respect to a background de Sitter metric rather than Minkowski space. So I pick up a piece proportional to the curvature, and then I also have my usual Peirce-Pauli mass term as well. Now, for the particular partially massless value, when m squared is equal to 1/6 r, this Lagrangian has a gauge symmetry, where h mu nu varies as d mu d nu, and then 1/12 r g mu nu, where again, this is the background de Sitter curvature. So it's this gauge symmetry here that's responsible for removing the helicity zero mode of the massive graviton. Okay, so why is this symmetry interesting? So first of all, it's a representation that's completely absent for the Poincaré group. So this is a new exotic representation that's very particular to de Sitter. Moreover, it's a symmetry that's absent for generic massive gravity as well. So for the massive gravity theories that we wrote down, their form was determined by the existence of this additional constraint. And it was then the constraint was responsible for removing the ghost-like degree of freedom. However, as far as we know, there's no underlying symmetry that fixes the form of these terms. It's really only the constraint Whereas for the case of this partially massless symmetry, the partially massless theory, the interaction terms are in fact dictated by the symmetry, which means for one thing that they're going to be protected under quantum corrections. So this makes it a much nicer quantum theory than generic massive gravity. Other interesting things about this symmetry is that because it gets rid of the helicity zero mode, it eliminates a whole host of issues that you have in massive gravity that go along with the helicity zero mode. And that includes the need for this strong coupling Weinstein mechanism. Also, the possibility of superluminalities of this theory can be related back to the helicity zero mode. And in the partially massless theory, you wouldn't encounter these difficulties at all. So you don't need nonlinearity to recover GR. All right, and then finally, the fourth and perhaps most interesting is that this symmetry is in fact incompatible with an arbitrary value for the cosmological constant. So let me say what I mean by that. The partially massless symmetry ties the value of the graviton mass to the value of the de Sitter curvature. So we get m squared is related to 2/3 lambda. So changing the value of the cosmological constant in the partially massless Lagrangian, this would violate this symmetry. So this is in stark contrast to GR, right? Where I can add an arbitrarily large cosmological constant to my theory, and this still respects diff invariance. So I have a cosmological constant, but it's tied to the mass of the graviton, the value of that Z. Exactly, okay, very good. Very good, very good. Okay, but on top of this, the value of the de Sitter curvature is now technically natural. So if I send this one parameter to zero, I recover diff invariance. So this is an exciting example of a symmetry which has potential to address the old cosmological constant problem. Yeah.
So this is work for generic. So if I say it's not an exact Sitter, but it's there plus some small predictions, is there some analog in this word, or do we have to go back to the
I'm sorry, could you
say? So if we just said, so you said this was, if it was exact Sitter, we're going to do prediction on top of that. If I kind of think this, well, it's not exactly the Sitter, it's close to the Sitter, it's not exactly that. Do we have some similar story here, or do we have to go back to the previous?
So I think. So are you talking about adding matter perturbations that say that violate this symmetry? Or, I mean, I think as long as these are small, you can treat this theory as having some approximate symmetry. I think I'm not answering your question. Okay. All right, so the question then, of course, is whether or not there is a nonlinear theory that realizes this partially massless symmetry. So this is work that I've been doing with Kurt Hinterwinkler, Claudia Durem, and Andrew Tully. And what we have is, so we took the original ghost-free massive gravity actions, and we reformulated them instead of with respect to a Minkowski reference metric, we reformulated them with respect to a de Sitter reference metric instead. And then we looked in this parameter space, so we looked at values of beta that could possibly give us a candidate partially mass, a nonlinear partially massless theory. So this is what we found for our candidate theory. So written again in terms of forms, I can express our candidate theory as the difference between the curvature of the dynamical metric minus the curvature of the background, the reference de Sitter metric, wedged with two Feuerbinds. So the first of these pieces is just the usual Einstein-Hilbert kinetic term. And the second piece here is in fact a usual mass term. I've just written it in this convenient way in terms of the de Sitter background curvature. So the promising features of this model and why we used it as this candidate theory is that you can show in fact that the helicity zero mode is in fact absent at the nonlinear level in what's known as the decoupling limit. So this involves sending little m and h to zero in such a way that the ratio remains fixed, and also sending m Planck to infinity in such a way that the combination m squared m Planck remains fixed.
Sorry, I didn't see what
you said. So little m is tied to h on its partially massless value. So m squared is equal to twice
so that's
h. That's the entire Lagrangian right there. Yeah. All right, so that's already very promising. And in fact, so this is the only theory of massive gravity on a de Sitter background for which this is true. The second thing we can do to look and see if in fact this is a nonlinear theory of partially massless gravity, since it's hard to do for the full theory, is we assumed a homogeneous and isotropic. Yeah. Oh, so when you expand in perturbations, your perturbations come with a 1/m Planck in front. So we're looking at, so we decompose into helicity modes and those show up with M Plancks and then we take this limit. So let's see, so the next thing that we can do to check for a nonlinear symmetry is if you assume a homogeneous and isotropic ansatz for the dynamical metric for the E, in fact, you can show that there is a manifest symmetry at the non-linear level for this theory. So we were starting to get excited at this point. But it turns out that if you do a brute force perturbative analysis, where you just start out with the Einstein-Hilbert kinetic term, and you add a mass term around a de Sitter reference metric, that there is no partially massless symmetry that can exist beyond cubic order. So I should say that for these two tests, we were interested in what was going on with this specific candidate model, but that this perturbative analysis we did for the most generic possible mass term you can write down. And there's simply no partially massless symmetry beyond cubic order. All right, so what are our conclusions? So the simple assumptions of just Einstein-Hilbert plus mass term with this de Sitter reference metric fails to give a nonlinear theory of partially massless gravity. The most straightforward thing that you can do is you can possibly introduce non-canonical kinetic terms for your dynamical field. So either two derivative non-Einstein-Hilbert terms or possibly higher derivative terms. Another thing you can do is try and introduce additional fields into this theory. So maybe this theory, maybe you can't realize the partially massless theory for a single massive graviton. But maybe one of these bimetric theories or multimetric theories will contain a partially massless graviton in it. Or possibly we have to do something more revolutionary in thinking outside the box in order to get this theory. All right, so just to sum up, surprisingly, it does seem that particle physics still has something to tell us, something interesting to tell us about low energy theories of gravity. So beyond answering interesting field theoretic questions, we found that pursuing this line of reasoning, we can expand the range of viable and compelling low energy theories of gravity. And in addition, through this partially massless theory of gravity, it seems that this approach can offer tantalizing new approaches to the old cosmological constant problem. So I'll stop there, thank you.
So in this partially massless case, you said you've solved the old cosmological constant problem because you've tied the cosmological constant to the mass, and this is truly constant. So how do you end inflation?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So you really need the full nonlinear theory in order to answer these questions. So at the linear level, what's happening is that, in fact, it's the mass of the graviton that gets tied to the cosmological constant of the reference metric and not of the dynamical metric. So it's possible that in a nonlinear theory, you could have instances where the CC associated with the dynamical metric is not the same as the CC associated with the reference metric. But these are certainly interesting questions that we need to answer in order for this to be a viable theory. And that also goes along with, even if in the gravitational sector, we find this nonlinear partially massless theory, we still have to couple to matter in such a way that respects this symmetry. And that's gonna put constraints on what kind of inflationary theories you can look at.
The idea would be the linked time universe is the partially massless protected, but matter is still doing whatever happens in the other universe.
Mm-hmm. Something like that, yeah.
Can you comment on the viability of the theory with the flat reference metric in explaining the acceleration?
So the idea is that if you start with the flat theory, let me go back to this guy. So this guy here, and you assume a homogeneous and isotropic ansatz, and you look at the Friedmann equations. So you find two solutions, two branches of solutions. And on one of these branches of solutions, what you find is that the mass term gives you something that looks like a cosmological constant, that basically remains constant in your Friedmann equation, has no A dependence whatsoever. And the parameter in front of this is the mass term. And so in that sense, it's technically natural. I believe, however, these theories have issues with the Weinstein mechanism and whether or not they're phenomenologically viable in that regard. But in terms of addressing the CC problem.
Is that also time-dependent in those theories, black holes will not be static?
That's a good question. I am not sure. That could be.
So
are you thinking of like some compactification or something like this, or some gauge theory?
Gauge theory, complete standard. I mean, there is, for the standard gauge, there is boundary theorem thing that prevents this from happening. Can this mass suspension emerge derived from non spin zero spin one?
I'm not sure.
Do something new, and then it will pop out.
Nobody knows. No known UV completion.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, that's something worth mentioning as well, is that the, so I mentioned earlier this problem of superluminalities, and that's related to the fact that in this decoupling limit, you can see that the helicity zero mode of this graviton has Galileon-like interactions. And these Galileons are known to have superluminal propagation around certain backgrounds. And in fact, one thing that this indicates is that this theory can't be UV completed in the standard Lorentz invariant way. So in fact, if this theory has a UV completion, it's going to be something unorthodox.
So it does have superluminal.
Yeah, it does. But I should say, so that's something that's only true, or that we only know to be true of the massive gravity theory on this flat reference metric. It's possible that in these bimetric theories or with other reference metrics, we're not sure what's going on. Yeah, so I think, we think in fact that partially massless might in fact avoid these problems simply because they are tied to this helicity zero mode. Of the massive graviton.
Any other questions?
No? Thanks, Rachel, again. Thanks very much.